champion becomes a legend. Mackay Beaver has won it.
Perkins goes in first. What a legend. What a champion.
Welcome to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
As always, a great pleasure to have you with us for another edition of This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Today we celebrate the life of an Australian who made her mark in tennis. She's also got a few other connections. She's got a basketball connection, she's got an AFL connection. Who knows what else? We might find out in the next hour. Her name is Nicole Bradke, and she is in the studio. Nick, how are you going?
I'm very well, Pete. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. You're looking well, but you always look well.
No, I'm doing really well, staying fit and looking after the family and doing what I usually do with my tennis and enjoying my time and keeping busy, which is great.
So what are you actually doing? What do you do for a crust these
days? So currently now what I do, and I have done since I stopped playing professionally, had children, then I'm coaching. So I coach not ridiculous amounts. I coach so I still enjoy it. There's nothing worse than probably doing something that you don't enjoy going to do. And I do enjoy coaching. And the kids that I coach, some are very good and some hit a nice tennis ball. And I thoroughly enjoy that, and it keeps me in shape. I probably do that three, four times a week. And then I do cardio tennis, which is gangbusters, which I absolutely love, which I do on a Wednesday and Friday morning, and I have probably about 15 people come in, got two courts running.
Now tell us a bit about cardio tennis.
So cardio tennis is I do a bit of my version of it just through the drills that I have done over my years of playing with coaches and things like that. So a lot of it is me feeding it out of the hand, and a lot of it is me with the tennis racket feeding the tennis balls. It's an hour of constant moving and drills and keeping women and men busy on the tennis court. You don't have to be a great tennis player to be able to play, but people love it. I get people from all different walks of life. I have lawyers. I have casual teachers. You know, Maddie Lloyd came in and did it for a little while. So it's just something that I really enjoy, and it's obviously more adult, so I'm not coaching kids, so that's generally what cardio tennis is.
So it's a bit of exercise, a bit of fun along the way.
It's a lot of fun. You know, you can clock up between how many people come, you know, four, five Ks that they end up running and hitting and doing all those sorts of things. So it's people love it.
And the difference is if you're running 4 or 5 Ks, that is your sole focus.
Yes.
But when you're actually doing something else, you probably don't realise that you're covering 4
Absolutely.
Or 5 Ks.
And, you know, I get people from varying standards, so that's why I have the two courts going. So I tend to group them a little bit in their ability, because when it comes to playing points, the ones that don't hit the ball so well don't really want to play with the ones that hit the ball really well. So I've just got a really great variety of people that come, and I just tailor it to who rocks up on the day, basically. So I've got set drills that I kind of do, and then I, you know, make it up as I go along.
And what about the kids you coach? Do you see the passion for sport in kids still these days? Because they've got so many other things that they can occupy their time with.
Look, I'm pretty an advocate of the kids that I coach stay at school, and I will work around their schedule. A lot of kids who are very good tend to get homeschooled, which I'm not really an advocate for. I think you can find enough great hitting in your day to be able to then study and hit and do what you need to do. So the kids that I coach, they, you know, some are once 12, 16, and varying age groups that I do, but they all go to school and I work around them. So most of my hours are pretty much after school, or if they want to, I'll get them up really early before school and we'll hit before they go to school. So, but yeah, kids have choices these days, and they're very fortunate here from Australia that we have a lot of great choices. My biggest thing is that I see with kids is whether they want to go to an individual sport or a team sport. A lot of kids like go to team sports, and it takes a sort of a very driven person to go to an individual sport, because you do spend a bit of time on your own. You've got to organise yourself. You've got to rely on other people. So it's the two ways that people go. But the kids that I coach, I'm pretty tough with them. We're out there, and we're out there to work hard, and I thoroughly enjoy it. It's something that I really enjoy doing.
Well, if you instill that work ethic in them at an early age, yep, it can stay with you for the rest of your sporting life.
That's exactly right. And it's just not with tennis too. I mean, it's probably a little bit more common now to go to college. So if they're not quite going to make it on the circuit, there's so many of these other wonderful options that they can do, and I would advocate going to college to study, to hit lots like they do in America, and then if they want to give it a go on the tour, they can certainly do that as well.
When you see the kids coming up through the ranks, Nick, do you see a mixture of the kids who want to earn $100 million like Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic, and the ones who are really just lovely, passionate kids about the sport of tennis? Is there a mix there?
I think, look, there is a mix, but a lot of it I see is a lot of, it sounds terrible, but mums and dads that are wanting, they're seeing their childhood life through their children and putting a lot of pressure on these kids to perform. It's a lot of hard work and very few people make it. So I think you've got to have the enjoyment first. You've got to have great parents who are willing to take you from A to B, because there is a lot of obviously travel involved, getting to tournaments and things. But then the most important thing is too, is that the parents have got to have a life as well, because you've got to come home and you've got to have something different to talk about. It just, you've got to have a lot of balance. And I was very fortunate in my career to have that. And you see that with Ash Barty. Mm. She has a lot of balance in her life. Her parents have not given up their day job. And I think that that's why, she is doing so well.
Why is it that the sport of tennis over the years has seemed to attract those sort of parents? We go back to the days of Mary Pierce, and of course we know what happened with Yelena.
Yeah, exactly.
Why is that? Is it just the time that they spend constantly sitting beside the court watching their child and just analysing everything that they do?
And they think that they know best, which they don't really. I think the sign of a good parent is to be able to let your entrust your child with someone who knows what they're talking about, and a lot don't want to do that. And that's where it gets a little bit unstuck. Yes, it probably can be a little bit more expensive and things like that, but I think the parents have to trust outside people to have their best interests in their child, and I think they have longer careers. They can still travel if they can get it with work, the parents, but they see the money, they see the big dollars, and, it's a sad state of affair that does happen in tennis with some of the tennis parents.
It's a bit like the old argument about whether parents should teach their kids to drive. Sometimes you're better off sending them to a professional because they will tell them the things that they need to hear.
And the only problem with that now, as I've had a child that does have a license, they've got to get 120 hours up.
Right.
And 120 hours is a lot of driving. So, it's interesting. It's, watching the young kids come up. But, I mean, hopefully that there are a lot of good ones out there, and that the kids do learn and they do listen to people who have sort of had that experience.
You mentioned Ash's name before. It's going to add another dimension when we're at Melbourne Park in about a month or so's time. It's going to be so exciting. It's always exciting there. Yeah. We love that fortnight.
Yeah, it's a great fortnight.
But there's another part to the equation, because realistically we've got a chance of an Australian holding up the Daphne Akhurst Memorial Cup.
It is. And you know what? The Australian Open's always a bit of a tricky one, because it's the first Grand Slam and everyone's pretty much had, well, officially had 6 weeks. There's no tournaments. They haven't had 6 weeks off. I mean, Ash has had a few weeks off. She's gone on holiday. She's played some golf. And that's what's going to make her a much better athlete mentally. But when they come down here, and it's hot, so there's a bit of an unknown of who's going to be playing well, who's not going to be playing well, and things like that. So, I mean, she's got a great opportunity. She loves playing on hard court. We saw that she won the end-of-year championships in China. So hard court is a good service. I mean, who would have thought she would have won the French Open?
Mm.
But, you'll take it. Just because you think that you're the best on grass, it doesn't necessarily mean that way. So, you know, she's going to have her good days and her bad days. We saw that in the Fed Cup when she was genuinely nervous in that second singles match. So as long as people don't tend to get too hard on her, she's here for the long haul. And, she's going to have ups and downs, but I think you know, she'll have a wonderful career.
When we sit in the commentary box at the Australian Open and various things, obviously when we're off air, we talk about what might happen. And the talk always was with Ash that she's got what it takes to be top 10 along the way. Did you ever think that she would ascend so quickly to the number one ranking in the world?
Oh, look, no, I don't think there's a timeline, but I think, you know, when she did go away, she was just homesick. You know, it is. Mm. It's, you know, coming from Australia, you've got to go away for long periods of time. You know, she said she's really close to her mum and dad and her family and her sisters, and she just didn't enjoy that being on her own. And having that time off, she was fortunate enough to have people around her that she could travel with, that she enjoyed being with. And she's mentioned Casey. She was, you know, a wonderful friend for her and really was a great companion. And then they did really well in doubles. So I think there's no, she's coming back as a more mature person and being able to handle it now. And now when she goes away for the year, she'll go back and she'll play tournaments that she enjoys playing. I mean, obviously now it's a bit different because she's required to play tournaments, but she will go back and play the tournaments where she likes going to the restaurants that she goes to. I don't think Ash is a shopper, but she'll go to those. She'll set her year out. She'll set her tournaments that she feels comfortable, the hotels that she likes to go to, the places that have good golf courses. And so whilst tennis is still her main object, she still has interests under those.
She's got a wonderful life balance, and that helps you as a person if you have interests outside of your work. It doesn't matter what your job is. If you've got something else to keep you interested and keep you passionate, then it helps with the journey of life.
Oh, exactly. And I think, I mean, she got that journey or that perspective, I think, from Ben Crowe, who has been added to her team, who has probably put things to her that she hadn't really thought of before. And, you know, having the balance, and she doesn't dwell too much if she does lose, because if she does lose these days, obviously someone's had to play very, very well to beat her. So, you know, everything's just going very nicely for her.
Yes, and it will get testing, because the further she progresses in the Australian Open, the more attention is going to be on her at home.
Yeah.
I remember back when Leighton played Marit Safin in that 2005 final, and it was the first of the night matches, and the television ratings were astronomical.
Yeah.
The build-up to that was incredible, and that's something that Ash is probably going to have to cope with if she's going to win seven times in Australia.
Well, I mean, it's maybe a bit of a blessing that she did win her first one offshore from Australia. So she knows now the level of interest that is in her. She's had that 6 months after winning the French and having the media and all of that. So now when she does come into, you know, the lead-up tournaments and the Australian Open, she's going to know what she has to do. Excuse me. But she has to be a little bit selfish in some respects, that she has to look after, A, her tennis first, and then doing whatever she needs to do, her media commitments and all that afterwards. So I think she's got that down pat now, though.
All right, that's enough of talking about everybody else. We're going to talk about you.
Oh, okay.
When we come back on the other side of the break. Have Nicole Bradkey as my guest on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. Plenty more to come with Nick after the break.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
A pleasure to have Nicole Bradkey as my guest on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Something just occurred to me. You're making history with this program, you know, because it's the first time we've had a husband and wife on as separate guests on this program.
Mark did it a little while ago, I think, before the World Championships.
He did.
Yeah.
And it was a very enjoyable chat.
Yeah, we've had an interesting time, I would say,
Now, where did it all begin for you two?
Okay, where did it all... It was the 1992 Barcelona Olympics.
Oh, so you walked away with two prizes from the Olympics.
Yeah, I did. So before you walk into the main stadium, we're all in another stadium waiting to go through, and obviously the whole Australian team's just sitting down, and you've got to get there so early. And I just happened to plonk myself down next to this tall gentleman, and it happened to be Mark Bradkey, and we just got talking. And also when we're in the village at the Olympics, we stayed in apartments. So the men and the women, so the apartments I was in with Todd and Fitzy and Wally and all of us, we're all in, and Neil Fraser, because he was the captain, and Wendy Turnbull. So we're all in one apartment, and the basketballers were above us and around us. And so we just got talking, and that's how we met, and love flourished.
And the rest is history. How long did it take for love to flourish?
Pretty quickly. You know, we got married fairly quickly. So I've been married now 26 years. So, time flies. So, but after that Olympics, I had to go to America, and he actually stayed on in Spain. And then it was then the big hoo-ha when he came back to Australia. Where was he going to play? Mm. And as Lindsay Gay says, I was his greatest asset, and unbeknownst, he was coming to Melbourne to play. So, that's how it all began.
Just going back to Barcelona, were you standing in the middle when the Archer fired?
Yes, I was out there, because that was my first Olympics. Yeah. Oh,
brilliant moment, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. It was just amazing.
The debate is there whether the actual arrow lit the flame. Yeah. They say that it went over the top of the cauldron, but who cares?
It doesn't matter. The whole spectacular. It was just... very, very enjoyable, a lovely time, and certainly cherish my memories from there.
Yeah, you know me well enough to know that we're not going to do this in order. We're going to jump all over the place.
That's so fine. While we're in Barcelona. You can fire questions at me, yes.
The bronze medal.
Yes.
Where is it?
I think it might be in the safe, actually. Yeah, it's in the safe.
Do you get it out every now and then and have a look
again,
at it?
I think early in the days when my two boys, Austin and Jensen, were at school and the Olympics came around, and they would say, you know, can your mum bring in her medal? And I'd say, sure. I mean, Mark finished fourth four times that he was at all the Olympics, so it was a bit of a sad moment there that he didn't actually get one. Came close, but it's just at home in the safe. So get it out and occasionally look at it. So fond memories, fond memories with Rachel McQuillan.
Yes, yep. I know actually the tennis center in Barcelona because Barcelona was my first Olympics as well, and there was a village not far away from where the tennis center was. It was at Vall d'Hebron,
right?
I think was the name of the tennis center. So we used to walk past the tennis center all the time. What were your memories of competition there? And first of all, what's it like to represent your country at the biggest sporting event in the world?
Well, tennis had really – I'd actually just probably missed out on going to Korea because that was in 88 when I actually had one of my better years. So
we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, I missed out on that. So then Barcelona was my first. So tennis was pretty much – just new coming back into it, but it was all, it was exciting. It was, fabulous. And I was playing with Rachel, and it was just something that we didn't expect because obviously sometimes regular doubles teams on the tour, you've got people playing doubles from different countries. So not a lot of, we were fortunate with the Woodies that they actually came from Australia and that they could play together. So Rachel and I had played a little bit in Fed Cup together, and we just played really well. It was really just something that we weren't expecting, and it just happened. So it was great.
Speaking of the Woodies, you're entwined with both of them because your two Grand Slam titles came with Mark.
Yeah.
But Todd's also got a little bit of a relativity to yourself.
Yes, he is married to my sister. So, that's talking of medals and lots of medals. He's got a beautiful collection of medals and a wonderful tennis player and a wonderful person, and one of my best mates, really, too, because we have spent a lot of time together.
Was one of your Grand Slams that you won with Mark against Todd?
Yes, and I nailed him in the neck here. He was playing with a rancher.
Yes.
And it was here at the Australian Open, and he just won with Mark, the men's doubles, and Tash was sitting there, and she was kind of hoping that I could win one. Mark did a great serve, and I crossed – and I hit this volley and I got him right in the throat, and never forgets.
Yeah,
she spoke at my 50th and said the same thing, that's what I'd done. It was hard playing with him because he wanted to do so well together that he kind of got a little bit antsy and all the rest. So it was kind of tough playing with him. But obviously I had success with Mark.
What's Christmas lunch like?
Oh, he cooks. He's a marvellous cook.
Really? I didn't
know
that.
Yeah, wonderful cook. So it's just a small family because Mark's parents live on the Gold Coast and Todd's mum, she's up at Foster – So it's just my parents and Tash and Todd and the kids, and it's very civilised.
Speaking of Mark, he had a lot to do with the redevelopment of the Davis Cup and the way that it's gone
down
a different path.
Yeah.
Do you think that the Davis Cup and the ATP Cup can coexist within 6 weeks of each other?
I, coming from someone who's represented my country, I guess the Davis Cup's probably different from the Fed Cup. I've played it in both formats. I've played it in the one where it's all in 1 week when I had my success against Steffi. So that one. It's a big undertaking financially for countries to put on a Fed Cup and a Davis Cup, and some countries just can't afford it. They might have great players, but their organisation is just not a lucrative one financially. So now for the women too, it's gone going back to Budapest, I think, for the next 3 years. So they've paid an awful lot of money to have it and to have it in that week. So if, I think for the next 3 years that it's going to be in April because they have to fit it into the calendar of where it flows the best.
Yeah.
So if it was going to be here, it'd have to be after the Australian Open or before the tournament start. So, you know, they've got to fit in it. I don't know. It's just we've had such a rich history in the Davis Cup with the men doing so well, and it's a success here. You know, I think the purists don't like it, probably don't really want it to succeed. I don't know if it's going to. Time will tell.
You touched on that win over Steffi. When you close your eyes, is that one of the moments that's most vivid to you from your career?
I think so, because it was after Wimbledon, I had to fly back to Japan and do an exhibition, and it was a time where actually my mum and dad were travelling with me, and they actually went to, I don't know where the British Open was in that year, but they went to the golf after my dad loves golf. So I went to Japan and then I flew back and then went to the golf. And I was with Liz and Pete Smiley, who Elvis is playing now up in Sydney. And we found out the draw and we had to play Germany. And not that I'm like to be very negative, but I said to Mum, Dad, you might as well just go home. You might as well just go home, I said. So anyway, we fast forward, we get to Frankfurt. Mum and Dad stayed in London, would go, and then I played my match and I won, and I played a great match. I just played really, really well. I had one of those days where everything was going right. Got back to the hotel room, Mum and Dad rang me from Heathrow Airport and said, "What was the score, doll? Where did you go?" I said, "I won." Dad goes, "Oh, don't be stupid, Nicole. Don't play a stupid joke." I said, "No, I did, Dad. I won." So they weren't too happy with me but Dad was very fortunate when I got to the semis of the French that he was over there with me. So they've seen a lot of great moments and things like that. But yeah, we got to the semis and the final of that Fed Cup. So yeah, it was a great week.
Well, as it turns out, you could have played Steffi in a French Open final.
I had a very close match point. So against Natasha Zareva. So yeah, one match point, and then she ended up losing Love and Love to Steffi in that final. So I'd played Steffi lots of times throughout my career. So kind of
you've got to have thought about it, Nick. If she lost Love and Love,
I would have got a game. Of course, I would have got one game.
Yeah, avoid the double bagel.
No, I would have got one game. So yeah, I love the clay courts. I grew up pretty much playing at Beaumaris Tennis Club on what we call Ontecar, so I knew how to slide and do all those things. So when I did go to Europe, it certainly wasn't a foreign surface for me to play on.
How much grass tennis did you play as a kid?
Not a lot. I played Easter tournament, Shepparton.
Yeah.
So that was probably my only real grass court tennis that I played, other than when I got a wild card to play in the Australian Open the last year it was at Kooyong. So, and I won a round, and that's what really got me kick-started to getting my ranking up and being able to go on the tour and play a lot.
Were you born with a tennis racket in your hand?
I certainly was. My mum played a lot, not professionally, but played probably midweek ladies. Mum would play 4 or 5 times a week. Dad played baseball for Australia. Very good cricketer, as in those days most baseballers play cricket. And Dad was really good at golf. So I just had the hand-eye coordination. Just used to go with Mum and I would just harp and harp and harp to play tennis with her. And so then they thought, oh, well, maybe we should get her lessons. And so they went to the club coach, and Dad thought that I probably needed a private lesson as well as group lessons. And he said, oh, no, I don't do private lessons for such young kids. And Dad said, look, just see what she's like. I think she's got the hand-eye coordination. I think she can do it. So I went along and he said, yep, we're okay to do private lessons. So I did a private and group lessons in those days. And Mum's side of the family all played tennis. So I just played tennis lots and lots my whole time. We lived in a court, put the chalk around on the courts and played tennis the whole time. I just loved it. It was great.
So you lived it and you breathed it.
Yeah.
Was it just filling in time when you were at school and when you were doing all the other things? It was just filling in time until the next time you hit a tennis ball?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, fast forward, I actually went to primary school in Frankston, and then my dad was a CEO of a trustees company in the city, and the travel was just getting too much. So I was nearing my primary school years, and one of the state programs I was in, there was a coach called Ken Richardson who was at Beaumaris Tennis Club, and his wife was the registrar at Mentone Girls Grammar. And so we moved up to Sandringham and I went to school at Mentone Girls Grammar, which was absolutely amazing with me at school. And Richo was the school at the school coach at the courts. And so I would just make it work. I would hit at school. And then I would hit at Beaumaris Tennis Club, but then I still went to school. So, and I still got my best friend from school, and she travelled with me for a little bit. So my whole progression, it just worked. I had people that made things work for me. The school worked with me, and I was a great asset to the school because they were getting a lot of publicity. So it was just a win-win situation.
One of the things, Nick, I love finding out from my guests on this program is the moment where the light bulb goes off,
yeah,
where you realise that you've got a gift,
yeah,
and that you are actually able to match it at a very high level.
Yeah.
When was that moment, that first moment for you?
I was doing really well from a junior perspective. I was being sent away. So I was one of the top juniors in my age group and would have to go. Like, I went away when I was 12 to America for 6 weeks in an Australian team and stayed with families and things like that. So I just was just so focused on trying to be the best that I could be. I think my real was when I started winning $25,000 tournaments, which were in Wollongong and Newcastle in my day when I was playing. And I started winning those, and it was like a good gradual process. And then I guess the validation was getting the wild card into the Australian Open. I won a round, and then that was it. Then it was off. And so I actually didn't finish year 12. I said to Dad, I'm going to give it a go on the circuit for a year. And if I don't like it or I don't feel like I'm contributing or being successful, then I will go back to school. I didn't end up going back to school, but that's how I started having my success.
Just when you won that match at the Australian Open on the back of the wild card.
Yeah.
Did you feel that pressure that we were talking about before that Ash is going to face? Because it seems as though every time we get an Australian player at the Australian Open, one win and everybody piles on the fact that they're going to win the tournament.
Exactly.
And it's just not going to happen.
No, it's not. I mean, obviously Liz Smiley was before me, Ann Minter. I probably think, I don't even know if Wendy Turnbull was probably still playing then, Di Ballastrat. We still had a lot of good female players that were coming through. So I just thrived on it. I just enjoyed it. And I think that's what you have to do. You have to enjoy what you're doing. And I just had really great people around me as well. So the whole process was very enjoyable. It wasn't hard work. It wasn't negative. I just embraced it.
You nearly got it wrong then.
I know. I haven't said it for a while. I haven't had to say it for a while.
I'll let you compose yourself. We'll take a break, and there's plenty more still to talk about with Nicole Bradke, not Nicole Provis or Nicole Provis, if you like. That's all still ahead of us on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
What a joy it is to have Nicole Bradkey as my guest on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. The singles titles. There were three of them,
yep.
And the first one was on home soil. What was that like in Brisbane?
Hot. Very, very hot, because I was really sick the week before. Hadn't picked up a racket. It was just, oh, and I thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do? Went up there. I actually took my best friend, who was a nurse, but that was very handy. And I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to give it a go and see how I go. And I just really didn't have the energy to either get angry or upset when I was playing. And I just played really, really well. It was so, so hot up there because they just redone the courts at Milton because obviously they were grass and had changed to rebound ace. Mm. I think it was 60-odd degrees on court.
They used to fry eggs on
my
those
shoes
courts.
Melted. Yeah. I was wearing Dunlop shoes at the time. And I don't know why this one day that I just bought – I mean, you should bring a second pair of shoes anyway, but I just put a second pair of shoes in my bag. And they had to go get them. And there is nothing worse when your feet are really, really hot and putting on a brand new pair of tennis shoes. It was just like, oh, my feet. Ended up having a really great week and winning. And it was, terrific. And then went to Sydney and played pretty well in Sydney as well.
Well, you must be pretty good in hot climates because your next title came in KL.
I know. It was really hot there too. And yeah, one there. Mum was actually with me on that trip, which was really, really nice. And they had a, it was like a, like Brisbane, how they've got like a
cantilever roof.
Yeah, over. So it was probably more humidity. I just loved playing in the heat. It didn't bother me. I didn't get upset. I didn't get anxious or anything else like that. The hotter it was, the better it was for me.
Was it hot in Auckland when you won the third one?
No,
I didn't think it would be.
No, I think Mark was with me that one. That was when he actually had the year, where he didn't really have a year off, but he took a period of time off and travelled with me. And, that was where I won that title and it was great. Yeah, he travelled with me that year, so it was a good year.
We've touched on your singles achievement at the French Open in 1988.
Yeah.
Steffi was at the peak of her powers. She'd won the Australian Open, the first one at Melbourne Park, not long before that. But what about the doubles? You are in the record books. You are a Grand Slam champion.
Yes.
How does that title sit with you?
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. With Mark, we just, I guess, complimented one another the way that he played. He played different, and that's why he did so well with Todd. You know, he sliced, he lobbed, he volleyed really well. He didn't, when, you know, the girls obviously serve not nowhere near as hard, he could handle it, he didn't get upset and things like that, where some guys are thinking, oh, my God, I should be returning these balls. They're not as hard as, you know, facing the men's serves. But he just could play mixed really well, and I obviously complimented him. So we actually beat Suk and Sukova in the US Open mix. So, and then, beat Todd and Arantxa at the one in Melbourne, which was pretty exciting.
Yeah, so what does that actually do for you, Nick? Where does that get you? Does it get you into certain clubs?
I'm in the last eight clubs, so at every Grand Slam, but I'm in there some through singles as well and doubles. So every Grand Slam that you go to, you can get tickets to go, and there's a beautiful venue that it is, and you go in there and you catch up with other people that have done the same as what I have. So it's nice. It's nice to be able to go back to a Grand Slam if you happen to want to travel and get tickets to go see it and, go and have a nice glass of wine or Pimm's and watch the tennis.
So is that what you've been doing when you come up and sit in the commentary box with me? You've been on the ink all day?
No.
You sure?
No, I maybe at the end of the day, but no. When you've sat in and you've watched a lot of matches. It's actually I think it's actually harder watching matches than it is actually playing. So,
do you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, especially people that you want to win and things like that, I think you become a great armchair expert. Oh, why didn't they do this? Oh, in my day, I didn't do that. So, yeah, I think it's I get a bit antsy when I'm sitting down for too long.
Well, especially in that cramped little commentary box that we used to share up above Rod Laver Arena. You got to know each other pretty well in that circumstance.
You certainly did. Yeah, you did. So, but yeah, I mean, that's just one of the things, that the opportunities that come your way after you finish playing tennis.
You're a great analyser of the game, a really good commentator, and I love working with you. Are you more stats-based or are you more what your eye tells you?
Absolutely. I think I'm more visual from what I see, or what people should be doing, or why they aren't doing things. Stats don't tell you a story. And sometimes you have to be able to read someone's body language and things like that. So, I mean, obviously you want to get a high percentage of first serves in and all those sorts of things, but you've almost got to have reaction time and play the ball. Stats do play a little bit. I mean, if you've got a coach, then you can look at the stats and go, well, okay, they serve, you know, 60% of the time to the forehand. She likes her backhand better than her forehand. So, I mean, you've got things in your mind that you go to, but if I'm calling a match or reading a match, I'm just purely going off what I see. And that's how I like to call it.
I'll give you one little stat. It just popped into my head. You know these things happen with me every now and then. Natasha Zvereva, who was Natalia Zvereva.
Yeah.
She holds one record that will probably never be broken in tennis. Do you know what that might be?
No. What would
she is the only person to do backstroke on centre court at the Australian Open.
Okay.
Remember when the courts flooded?
Yeah, when flooded? It flooded, yeah. And Gigi Fernandez went out, Renee Stubbs was out, and it was that murky colour, yeah.
Yeah, Natasha just laid down and started doing the backstroke.
As you do.
Well, I think they had some swimming championships at Rod Laver Arena at one stage. I think it might have been the World Championships.
Maybe.
They actually
put a pool in there. Yeah, it's had a lot of grass court flown in. It's had a lot of concerts, obviously, so it's a great venue.
Someone you know might have played there a few times
as well.
Yeah,
we've seen a few basketball games there as well. So it was going gangbusters in the NBL, and when Mark was playing, he was very fortunate to be playing at a great time.
Fed Cup was something dear to your heart as well. You represented Australia so many times.
Yes.
It was a labour of love for you.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, it's such an individual sport that, you know, you're away so often. And some, you know, often you don't play a lot of other tournaments where Australians are, or they can't get into tournaments because your ranking's higher. It's just a really good week of bringing everyone together, and obviously played in some and then coached some. It's just a lot of fun week, and it's not a week of it's a wee week that everyone contributes, and it's a lot of fun to be with like-minded people.
You mentioned that you were a coach. When it ended, it wasn't pretty in some ways.
No.
What are your thoughts looking back on that now?
Look, it's not the fact that I was not doing it. It was just the way that I was informed. I think when I had done it for 7 or 8 years, there just should have been a better way to have told me.
And Alicia
knows that.
Are you two okay now?
Yeah. I said to her that I was very disappointed in the way that she could have handled it a lot better. I was very forthright.
So basically she rang you and told you.
Yeah, she just told me like a few days before. And she was coming into town a couple days later. And I just thought that, and, you know, we were really good friends. I'd helped her. I just felt that she owed it to talk to me, not over the phone, that she needed to tell me face-to-face that I was. It was a hard decision for her to make, and it was probably one that she didn't really necessarily had to do. But I think in life there are some decisions that you have to make and you have to do the right way, and I just felt that was one of them. So we're fine now. I made it known, and she was very apologetic, and she knew that she didn't handle it the best way possible, so we're all fine now.
Speaking of the next generation, I want to talk about that in our final segment when we come back, because I mentioned that Nick has a bit of a relationship with the AFL, and it's through her son Austin. We'll talk about that when we come back with our final segment on the other side of the break on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Our final segment, what has been a great chat with Nicole Bradke on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funeral, Celebrating Lives. All right, tell us about this AFL connection.
Okay, so my eldest, Austin, 19, played basketball his whole entire career, went to the States when he was about 16, 17, had a look at some colleges that were interested in him, came back and says, nope, don't want to live here. I said, fine, no problem. What do you want to do? He played football. Two of his best mates are Max and Ben King, so one on the Gold Coast, one at St Kilda. Clubs got wind that he was not going to go back to basketball. He is 6'9", moves pretty well, was a very good footballer. Hence, we had a lot of offers for him to go to clubs because he's gone as a rookie B and they can and each club can have three. He chose Melbourne. He does barrack for Melbourne. I was a devil's advocate and was, you know, trying to say, look, this and this and this. It was a very difficult decision, but ultimately it was his decision. And so he's gone with Melbourne and he's loving every single minute of it.
Is mum loving every minute of
it? I am loving it. It is a lot more nerve-wracking than obviously basketball from a getting hurt point of view. He played in the VFL last season, so which was great. Just getting back into the swing again, but Melbourne have been absolutely wonderful. He's got 46 new best friends. Max Gawn is amazing with him. All the midfielders are great. They take him out and he absolutely loves it.
I think that's him on the phone now. I think your handbag's ringing.
Oh, golly. Oh.
Just take that
anyway,
over here.
I'll put it down on the phone.
You know what happened? You've been in radio for long enough. When the phone rings when you're in
it's
the studio, that's a slab.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So we might go off and have some of that PIMS that you were talking about.
There you
about
go. Well, I do have another son too. He's Jensen and he's gorgeous and he's 15 and 6'7", but he's our basketballer. So they're both great kids and a lot of enjoyment.
We're just about at the end of our time. I wish it could be longer, but my last question is for the boys, and in particular Austin, who is about to embark on sport at the top level.
Yes.
With everything that you have learned in your career, if he asked mum for one gem of advice, what would it be?
Hard work. Hard work will get you. You might not have the skill level as some people, but if you're prepared to go in there and do the hard yards and do the one percenters and the hard work, eventually things will go your way. And that's what I always say to him, hard work, nothing beats hard work.
Well, it served you pretty well.
It
was a great career and it's been great to relive it with you. I'll look forward to seeing you around the grounds of Melbourne Park at some stage in about a month's time. Nick, thanks for coming in. It's been a joy to share an hour with you.
Thank you, Pete.
Nicole Bradke joining us on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funeral, Celebrating Lives. We'll be back with another great of Australian sport next week at the same time. I hope you can join us then.